friends, and welcome back. Thank you so much for sticking with us. We are already almost halfway through the course. And if you're feeling like you don't understand it all, don't worry. That's pretty much how everyone is feeling at this point. Now that we're leaving the surface level and starting this episode going deeper into the details of capitalism, you'll probably start learning things in these next few episodes that give you a better understanding of concepts that we've covered previously. So in the past chapters, Marx has finally done enough work to explain the origins of absolute surplus value, which is another way of saying exploitation. Remember that Marx operates at different levels of abstraction. And the first chapter we discuss, he brings us from the most general form of labor to the particular form it takes in capitalist production. We'll learn some other elements in the production process and how the same thing can play different roles or take on different forms depending on context. We'll learn about individual and productive consumption, constant and variable capital, and discuss a bit about humanity's relationship to nature under capitalism. In the last chapter of this episode, we'll discover the rate of surplus value. So here we go.
You're beginning to hear alarm about a second mortgage shock.
Last month alone, more than 70,000 families lost their homes.
Stock markets fell faster than a skydiver without a parachute.
The coronavirus pushing unemployment to its highest level since the Great Depression.
American billionaires have gained $1 trillion in wealth just this year.
Millions of Americans are receiving food stamp benefits for the first time.
Would you swap working for a company in favor of living in a communist country? A surprising number of millennials in the US would do precisely that.
Welcome back, comrades, to episode 5. Today, we'll begin part 3 of the book, which is titled The Production of Absolute Surplus Value. We'll be looking specifically at chapters 7-9, making our way from labor power to some more particulars of absolute surplus value. We'll see Marx continuing to build the conceptual apparatus necessary for approaching the dynamics of class struggle, which is really the core motor of capitalism. In the last episode, we searched for the origins of surplus value in the exchange process, concluding that if equivalents or non-equivalents are exchanged, there's no additional value created. So Marx said it had to be found within and without the sphere of circulation. The capitalist needs a commodity whose use value entails the production of value, and that commodity is labor power. The commodity is bought on the market, but like all commodities, it's consumed in private, or in this case, in the factory. The value of labor power is, like all commodities, the socially necessary labor time required for its production and reproduction. The key antagonism will be between the value of labor power and its use value. This is one of the things that part 3 examines. So with that, let's move on to chapter 7, which is the labor process and the process of producing surplus value. It's divided into two sections that address each respectively, right? First, there's a labor process, and then there's a labor process under capitalism to produce surplus value. So he begins chapter 7 by defining labor at the broadest level of abstraction, as something that transcends different modes of production and is in some senses eternal. At this point, whether or not the labor is under the command of the capitalist or another ruler or the peasant or the individual is of no difference. The labor process is about producing use values. On the first page, Marx writes, quote, "Labor is, in the first place, a process in which both people and nature participate, and in which a person of their own accord starts, regulates, and controls the material reactions between themselves and nature. They oppose themselves to nature as one of her own forces, setting in motion arms and legs, head and hands, the natural forces of the body, in order to appropriate nature's productions in a form adapted to their own wants. By thus acting on the external world and changing it, the person at the same time changes their own nature," end quote. So there's a lot to unpack here, right? I mean, first and most broadly, labor is a process of transforming materials in order to produce useful things, right? Not necessarily exchangeable things. Second, it might appear like there's a hard and fast dichotomy between nature and humanity, where, you know, nature is passive and the latter is active, which is why Marx talks about the labor appropriating nature for their own intentions and ends. But there really isn't such a harsh dichotomy because Marx notes that humans are part of nature, for one, and for two, by changing the external world, they also change themselves. Now, humans and nature are in a dialectical relationship, and when humans act on the world, they transform not only the world, but also themselves. I think this is quite interesting, and it harkens back to something that Marx wrote in the introduction to the Grundrisse, which is that subjects produce objects, but also objects produce us as subjects. So there's a sort of linear biological interpretation of this, which is like that consuming food produces us as living beings. But there's also a more general, perhaps sociological interpretation, which is that our production of objects and use of them literally changes the kinds of people that we are, the kinds of relations we have with ourselves, others, and the world. Marx then acknowledges that all things act on and with nature. Here, however, he writes, quote, "We presuppose labor in a form that stamps it as exclusively human," end quote, which means that it results in a product, quote, "that already existed in the imagination of the laborer at its commencement," end quote. And this is where Marx distinguishes the bee from the architect, writing that you can tell the worst architect from the best of bees in that the architect creates something in their mind before materializing it in the world. There are a lot of important questions and potential objections that arise at this point. I mean, one has to do whether this division between animals and humans holds, and indeed there's ample research out there now to show that what Marx says here isn't really true. Animals have a great deal of will and intentionality. It's clear that Marx separates humans from animals, not only in Capital, but elsewhere, especially in his earlier work like that compiled in the Paris Manuscripts of 1844. Some of this comes from the cultural context, while some of it comes from the limited available knowledge in Europe about other animals, and other from the philosophical works he's building on, most notably Hegel. So there's definitely an anthropocentrism in here. And these are important questions. And it doesn't mean that Marx was wrong or that what follows isn't accurate, because Marx's jaunt through this really high level of abstraction is really a way to get at the labor process under capitalism, right? So, I mean, Marx is really after the human labor process as it existed in his day. And so while it might be incorrect to say that humans are distinguished from animals because of their intentionality and their ability to plan what they produce, it's still okay conceptually to define some kinds of labor as human labor. And it doesn't really alter the form of the argument or what follows. The other thing is that Marx is focusing on labor because he's after surplus value. He's not saying that labor is the exclusive function of humans, or that humans are defined by their capacity to labor, or that's all that humans should do. But labor in general is a transformative process involving humans and nature. It's a metabolic relationship between humans and nature. So back to the text. At the end of the paragraph on bees and architects, he says it's purposeful work in which the body and its organs are oriented toward an operation, and it demands close attention. We might find work desirable, but we might not find it desirable. And if we don't find it desirable, then the more demanding that it is. So in other words, labor isn't something that is always necessarily enjoyable. It's something that has to be done because particular use values must be created. He then breaks down the labor process into three components. So there's the actual labor, there's the subject of labor, or what's being worked on, and then there's the instruments of labor, which is what are being used in order to work on the subject. Now, if the subject of labor is furnished purely by nature, it's considered a free gift of sorts, and this will become important later on in the book. But if the subject of labor, what it's working on, is itself the product of labor, then it's a raw material. So in other words, if we can imagine a plot of land totally untouched by human labor, it would not properly be a raw material. But this is very hard to imagine and actually impossible, as we'll see. But this definition of raw material is important. Quote, all raw material is a subject of labor, but not every subject of labor is raw material. It can only become so after it has undergone some alteration by means of labor, end quote. In other words, raw materials are values. Marx then distinguishes different kinds of raw materials and different ways that the components of the labor process, the subject, and the instruments factor into production. So some raw materials enter directly into production, right? Like yarn for spinning. But others are auxiliary or ancillary, and they facilitate production, like steam or coal. And so when steam or coal are used in the production process, their form totally disappears. But with yarn, its form doesn't disappear. Animals and plants, he later says, we tend to think of them as natural, but, quote, in their present form are not only products of, say, last year's labor, but the result of a gradual transformation continued through many generations, end quote. And it's the same with land. And this is really important. As early as the German ideology, Marx and Engels acknowledged that there was no longer any such thing as nature that was distinct from people. And this is a key foundation for environmental policy under socialism. Nature isn't outside of us. We're part of it. We're internally related to it. And this is key for working towards environmental justice, right? Capital views nature as a resource to exploit. But Marx is saying that we are part of nature, and whenever we transform nature, we also transform ourselves. And so it's not something external that we just dominate and appropriate. It's something that we must be in a relationship with. Marx then clarifies that the same object can be both a raw material and an instrument of labor. So when a cattle is used to produce manure, it's an instrument of labor. When it's used as a piece of meat, it's a raw material. And this is important to highlight the dynamism of the categories that Marx is working with. Later on in volume two, he'll talk about how if I use my house to sleep in, it's not a form of capital. But if I use my house during the day in order to arrange a production process or engage in a production process, then it's a form of fixed capital. And so the same thing, the same object can, under different conditions, occupy a different relationship within the labor process and within capitalism. There's also a note here that through the labor process, humans produce use values, and through the capitalist labor process, they produce exchange values too, yet the process of labor disappears in the product. And when this takes place under capitalism, it results in the commodity fetishism that we read about in chapter one. This is another reason why we can't just take the appearance of things and view them as static. We have to look at everything as dialectically unfolding and as a process as well as a product. So we're now turning from the production of use values and concrete labor to the production of exchange values and abstract labor. It's not the products themselves that define different modes of production. As Marx writes on 128 Online, 175 International, and 286 Penguin, quote, it is not the articles made, but how they are made and by what instruments that enables us to distinguish different economic epochs, end quote. And added to this, of course, are the social relations under which articles are produced. However, as we'll see, there's a relationship between the labor process, how production is taking place, and the social conditions under and for which it's taking place that's going to be important when we go to the rise of capitalism in especially the part of the book on relative surplus value. So under capitalism, the labor process entails two things: the means of production, which include raw and auxiliary materials, instruments and tools, machinery and so on, and then the commodity of labor power. The means of production and raw materials are only brought to life when labor sort of seizes upon them. A machine, Marx says, which does not serve the purposes of labor is useless. In addition, it falls prey to the destructive influence of natural forces. Iron rusts and wood rots. Yarn, with which we neither weave nor knit, is cotton wasted. living labor must seize upon these things and rouse them from their death sleep, change them from mere possible use values into real and effective ones, end quote. They must be, quote, bathed in the fire of labor, end quote, as he puts it. That's on page 130 online, 178 International, and 289 Penguin. So here Marx is demonstrating that it's really labor that creates values, that brings things to life, and this will be important when we go to the next couple chapters. Marx then introduces a key distinction between individual consumption and productive consumption. And this is just another instance in which Marx has introduced a category and then he's going to break it down and say, well, there's actually really different forms of this and they each have different sort of logics, right? So productive consumption is different from individual consumption. The latter is when the individual consumes a use value in order to live, right? Individual consumption is what workers do. Productive consumption is what capitalists do. So Marx writes that, quote, the product, therefore, of individual consumption is the consumer himself. The result of productive consumption is a product distinct from the consumer, end quote. So again, if you remember the bit from the Grundrisse about how the subject not only creates an object, but the object also creates a subject, as we individually consume things, we actually change ourselves. So in a society, for example, in which we individually consume means of communication like cell phones or smartphones or whatever, the product is the person using it, right, in our social relations. But it's not so with productive consumption. Productive consumption is important for the production of capital because it means that capital has to produce commodities to then enter into the production process again, right? So individual consumption is when I purchase something and then consume it. Productive consumption is when the capitalist purchases something and then puts it into a new production process. And this is an important category for understanding the production of capital because it means that capital has to produce commodities to then produce more commodities, and it has to invest more and more in the production of commodities. So this is another glimpse at the necessarily expansive nature of capital. Now, at the end of section one, we return to our would-be capitalist or a capitalist in embryonic form. Marx says that capitalism takes the labor process as it finds it. We'll learn more about this in part four, but it's the first mention of it, and it's really important because capitalism doesn't automatically and instantaneously revolutionize the labor process. It seizes on the existing ways that things are produced and then gradually subjects them to their command. And this is really going to be the key distinction between the production of absolute surplus value and the production of relative surplus value that we'll cover in a couple of episodes. But what capitalism does change immediately are the social conditions of the labor process. And there are two things in particular. One, the labor process now takes place under the control of the capitalist. And two, the product is owned by the capitalist. It's all their property. And the last few sentences of this section are important. Quote, the labor process is a process between things that the capitalist has purchased, things that have become their property, end quote. Now, of course, the labor power is a thing. So we see that the way in which capital objectifies the body, commodifies the body. But the dialectical and maybe even organic relationship to nature is therefore fundamentally altered, and the worker is alienated from the process and the product of their work. So moving on to section two, the production of surplus value. The capitalist buys commodities in order to produce surplus value. So not only a use value, but a value that can be realized through exchange and one that has a greater value than the commodities they bought in the first place. We now turn from the labor process, in other words, to the process of producing surplus value. We know that the value of commodities is their socially necessary labor time, and we're assuming that things trade at their values, i.e., that the price corresponds to the value. This also holds for the capitalist. So Marx is going to run through some examples here of a capitalist purchasing certain quantities of raw material, means of production, and labor power. The worker uses the means of production, raises them from the dead, creates something new. Yet at the end, after Marx runs through these scenarios on 134 Online, 185 International, and 297 Penguin, quote, our capitalist stares in astonishment. The value of the product is exactly equal to the value of the capital advanced. The value so advanced has not expanded. No surplus value has been created, and consequently, money has not been converted into capital, end quote. This is because of a confusion between the value of labor power and the value that labor power creates when its use value is consumed. So in vulgar economy, we can't understand the production of surplus value. The difference hinges on this, the distinction between the value and the use value of labor power. Quote, but the past labor that is embodied in the labor power and the living labor that it can call into action, the daily cost of maintaining it and its daily expenditure and work are two totally different things. The former determines the exchange value of labor power, the latter is its use value, end quote. And that's 135 Online, 188 International, and 300 Penguin. So this is Marx's contribution, the theory of surplus value. And he continues, quote, therefore, the value of labor power and the value which that labor power creates in the labor process are two entirely different magnitudes. And this difference of the two values was what the capitalist had in view when he was purchasing the labor power, end quote. So if you remember, on the very first page of the first chapter, when Marx says that use values don't concern us here, that's sort of the work of history, of commerce, and so on and so forth, he's really clearing the stage so that he can do the work necessary to get us here, and we arrive at a point in which a particular use value is absolutely fundamental. The particular use value of labor power is not only to create value, but to create more value than it itself has. And here, we are still operating with the exchange of equivalents. There's no violation of the idealistic marketplace that Marx set up in Chapter 2. So where does the new value come from then? Marx writes that producing value and producing surplus value are only distinguished by time. Creating surplus value is nothing but the continuation of the production of value beyond a definite point. This is what we'll later define as necessary labor and surplus labor. And just as a note, in the first footnote on the last page of this chapter, Marx addresses the distinction between skilled and unskilled labor and how it doesn't impact surplus value, although it can impact the rate of surplus value, and all of this will make sense in a bit. So that brings us to the end of chapter 7. We'll now move on to chapter 8, constant capital and variable capital.
So let me get this straight. What you're saying is that surplus value is another way to say exploitation. A capitalist pays us to work, and he keeps all of the work that we create while we get a wage to keep us alive until the next shift.
Yes. What for the capitalist is surplus value is for the worker exploitation. Surplus value is surplus labor time, and so the more surplus labor we work, the more surplus value the capitalist gets, and the more we're exploited because we're producing strictly for the capitalist during this time. And as we'll see later, there's a couple of different strategies the capitalist employs to get this from us. This chapter is fairly brief and really entails Marx returning to the labor process and creating some new categories to understand this process under capitalism and to help us uncover the production of surplus value. Both chapters 8 and 9 aren't too difficult, but they're important, and personally, I find it helpful to take notes on it so you can consult them later when he returns to these categories and builds on them both later in Volume 1 and in the later volumes of Capital. So chapter 8 is pretty straightforward. Marx is redefining the labor process under capitalism, which, as we know, entails the means of production as well as labor power. In this chapter, though, he's approaching them as values. And remember that for something to be a value, it must have a use value and an exchange value. And under capitalism, it must be produced for the exchange value. Marx groups the means of production in raw materials and basically every commodity that goes into the production process, including the factory, energy, and so on, into constant capital. He calls them constant capital because in the production process, their value remains constant. In other words, the value of the means of production are transferred during the production process into the final commodity. The value of the raw materials is transferred during the production process into the final commodity. The example he gives to work through this is cotton. Marx writes a lot about cotton because the textile industry was really important for English capitalism at that time. Recall from the last episode that capital thus far has been defined as value in motion, or more precisely, value that through its motion expands. So as such, if you have cotton and weaving machines sitting idly in a factory, they're not capital and they're not values. Their use value and exchange value is realized only through motion. It's only the worker who, as Marx writes, quote, raises by mere contact the means of production from the dead, makes them living factors of the labor process, and combines with them to form the new products, end quote. That's 142 online, 194 international, and 308 in Penguin. So the worker not only preserves their values, but transfers them to the new product. With the cotton, this is easier to see. If I have $10 worth of cotton and I spin it to create 5 shirts, then each shirt contains $2 worth of cotton, and the cotton itself is visible in the product. It's a bit different with machinery because the machinery itself doesn't physically enter into the t-shirt. In volume 2, Marx will further divide constant capital into circulating capital and fixed capital. And circulating capital is like the cotton, that which literally moves, while fixed capital, like the spinning machine, remains fixed. It remains locked in place. But let's say that the spinning machine costs $100. If throughout the entire life of the machine, it produces 100 t-shirts, then each t-shirt will embody a value of $1 from the machine. This is the conclusion he reaches on 144 online, 197 international, and 312 in Penguin that, quote, we find that during this period, its use value has been completely consumed and therefore its exchange value completely transferred to the product. For instance, if a spinning machine lasts 10 years, it is plain that during that working period, its total value is gradually transferred to the product of the 10 years, end quote. Constant capital only transfers its existing values to the new product. While it creates a new use value, a new qualitative thing, it does not create a new exchange value, a new quantitative magnitude. It's otherwise with labor power, or the subjective element of production. Let's go to page 146 online, 201 international, and 316 Penguin. Quote, while the laborer, by virtue of their labor being of a specialized kind that has a special object, preserves and transfers to the product the value of the means of production, they, at the same time, by the mere act of working, create in each instant an additional or new value, end quote. And a little later on, he again defines surplus value, quote, the action of labor power, therefore, not only reproduces its own value, but produces value over and above it. This surplus value is the difference between the value of the product and the value of the elements consumed in the formation of that product, end quote. So, i.e., it's a difference between the means of production and the labor power. Labor power is variable because it not only transfers existing values and reproduces its own value, it at the same time produces new value. Now, the reason it's called variable capital is because this new value can vary according to various circumstances. These circumstances will concern us later in the book, and they're fundamental to ongoing developments and struggles around capitalism, which always seeks to produce more and more surplus value. Because the use value of labor power is independent of its exchange value, if the productivity of labor is increased, more surplus value is produced. Now, the value of the means of production can also change when we remember that value is a dynamic social relation. So imagine that a capitalist buys a machine at its existing value of, say, $1,000 in January in order to use it for the entire year. By the end of the year, the value should be totally transferred to the new products. Yet if by May, the socially necessary labor time required for the production of that machine has decreased by half, it means that the value of the machine the capitalist bought has also decreased. In this case, the value of the means of production has changed, but it is still only transferring its value to the finished commodity. And this, by the way, is one reason why the capitalist wants to make workers work as long and as quickly as possible, because they want to consume, productively consume, all of the raw materials and means of production before their value is decreased by improvements in the production process elsewhere. So to sum up again, machinery, instruments of labor, raw materials, auxiliary materials are constant capital in that their value remains constant during the production process. They never give the final product any more value than they have. Labor power is variable because it adds new value, and the extent to which it adds new value varies according to different circumstances, like the productivity of labor. If a worker is forced to work two machines instead of just one, the worker will produce more surplus value than if they were just working the one machine. All right, so now we move on to chapter 9, the rate of surplus value, where Marx is going to look closer at variable capital and the value it produces. The argument here is pretty straightforward, but there's a lot of math that he uses to prove his case along the way. But the fundamental concepts introduced here are those of necessary labor, which is not to be confused with socially necessary labor time, and then surplus labor. So the capitalist lays out their capital in the form of constant and variable capital. To that, a surplus is going to be added. So in other words, the value of the finished commodity will equal constant capital plus variable capital plus a surplus. Now, necessary labor time is the time during which the worker works to produce new values that equal their wage. So suppose my working day is 10 hours and I get paid $10 for the day. Now, if at the end of the day I've produced $20 in value, then in 5 hours I've reproduced my own wage. That's the necessary labor time. And surplus labor is any time I work beyond that. So with the example above, my necessary labor time is 5 hours and my surplus labor time is 5 hours. At the end of the day, I've reproduced my wage of $10 and produced a surplus value of $10 for the capitalist. The rate of surplus value will be surplus labor divided by necessary labor. So continuing with the example, the rate of surplus value is 5 over 5, or 100%. Marx also calls this the rate of exploitation. In other words, it's the rate at which my labor power is exploited. This is a tremendously helpful agitational tool to use with workers, although it's easier in some workplaces than in others. In general, you can figure out how long it takes you to produce what you're going to be paid, and then anything after that is basically a free gift to the capitalist. I, at one point, was a personal trainer in a gym, and I knew what my boss charged my clients for an hour session, and I knew what I got paid for an hour session. And so it was really transparent and easy for me to calculate the rate of exploitation by the hour. Now, in the last section on Senior's last hour, Marx ultimately reinforces that this is a rate. So to counter-organize against movements to limit the length of the working day, the bourgeoisie tried to say that if you reduce the working day from 12 hours to 11 hours, then you eliminate all the profit because it's in the last hour that all profits are made. But that's obviously ridiculous because even if you work for 30 minutes, you won't get paid for the full value produced through the consumption of your labor power for that time. You'll be paid for the value of your labor power. And as Marx will put it in the next chapter, both necessary labor and surplus labor glide into each other. But nonetheless, this was a serious argument at the time, and it really goes to show the superficiality of so much bourgeois thought and also the way that bourgeois political economy works totally to serve capital and its interests.
I'm sure we all know the different ways that capitalists try to extract more and more labor from us. And one thought that came to mind, though, when you were talking about the last hour argument, is that it's a familiar argument because it's actually the same claim that capitalists today use against increasing the minimum wage. They say that if businesses are forced to pay workers a $15 minimum wage, the company will have to increase prices or go out of business. Why is this a false argument? And what is the connection to the last hour here?
So the first point, and to return to our discussion in the last episode, is the idea of science as impartial, right? So Nassau Sr. is an Ivy League professor, basically using his credentials and expertise, making all kinds of these meticulous calculations, using all this data, producing all these convoluted arguments in order to justify greater exploitation. This is why Marx writes that, quote, "the heart of a man is a wonderful thing, especially when it is carried in his wallet," end quote. Senor even said that children were better off working because if they weren't working, they'd get into trouble, they'd become immoral, right? But the argument doesn't hold because surplus value is surplus labor, right? Labor beyond that which the worker is reproducing their own wage. So if I work for 1 hour, right, I don't get paid for all that I produce during that 1 hour. There's still surplus labor. There's still surplus value being made, right? And there's still exploitation. I mean, just look at the gig economy, right? Even a 5-minute Uber drive is a source of surplus value and surplus labor for the capitalist because the worker doesn't get paid for the entire product, right? The entire service. On the other hand, though, Senor's argument shows that if there was no surplus labor, there would be no profit and therefore no exploitation. And really, that's what socialists want, right? And, you know, this kind of capitalist science is always used against workers' struggles to increase wages. And because capitalism is based on surplus value, the working day can never be reduced to socially necessary labor time required for the production of labor power, right? And it's like a threat that's used. And in some ways, it's real because capitalists can move where labor power is cheaper, right? So that's why, as Marx will show us in chapter 10, workers as individuals are powerless, and that's why we need international working class unity. I'd like to make just one final note before ending, which is the difference between the rate of exploitation or the rate of surplus value and the rate of profit. The rate of exploitation or surplus value is only concerned with necessary labor time and surplus labor time. It's only concerned with the difference between the wage or variable capital and surplus labor time. The rate of profit is concerned with surplus labor time, with variable capital, and with constant capital. So in other words, it also takes the means of production into account. So whereas the rate of surplus value is surplus labor over necessary labor, the rate of profit is surplus labor divided by necessary labor plus constant capital. Or another way to put it is that it's surplus labor divided by variable capital plus constant capital. Because the denominator is higher, the rate of profit is always lower than the rate of exploitation. Now, these are ultimately two different class viewpoints on the production process, right? Workers were concerned with the rate of exploitation. The capitalists are concerned with the rate of surplus value, but they're also really concerned with the rate of profit. And this is going to be important when we get to chapters 15 and 25, although Marx primarily analyzes the rate of profit in volume 3. So with that, comrades, we're at the end of chapter 9. Over the past few episodes, we've discovered what value is, what use value and exchange value are, what commodity exchange is, what value and price are, what money is, the different functions it plays, the different contradictions within it. We've gotten some early definitions into what capital is, and we've figured out surplus labor. We've got all the necessary building blocks to dive into chapter 10 on the working day, which we'll cover in the next episode. Now, chapter 10 is really an amazing chapter. We'll get a bit of a reprieve from all the equations and so on. It's a little bit longer, but there's a lot of historical information. There's testimony of factory inspectors. There's a lot of history of class struggle in England during the mid-19th century. And we'll get to talk about the states. We'll discover the difference between individual capital and collective capital and more. So happy reading, comrades, and solidarity.